I saw a shadowy figure in the tunnel. I told them to stop.
Whoa. It's a restricted area.
Finally, I pulled my gun. Pulled the deadly weapon and started running.
Don't make me shoot. I'll do it. Are you deaf? You hear me? You'll freeze?
You dick. I'm Derek Jeter. You shot me.
You shot Derek Jeter.
He's a biracial angel.
You should have shot A-Rod.
Welcome to the Pinstripe Alley podcast. The Yankees have just lost 2 out of 3 against the Tigers, which is kind of a disappointing follow-up to their 5-game winning streak that they had carried in at about this time last week. And up until the Tiger series, they won the last game of the series against the Astros. Then they swept the White Sox, and they won a makeup game against the Royals on Monday. So it was looking pretty good then, but the 2 out of 3 series loss to the Tigers, kind of annoying considering they had a pretty good chance at winning on Thursday afternoon. The fact that they pummeled David Price makes it pretty disappointing that they couldn't do the same against Buzitz. Who was the guy that started today?
Kyle Loebstein.
Yes.
Future Cy Young.
Yeah. Him and Brett Oberholzer. They're just devastating.
Just what a race is going to be
next year.
For the Cy Young?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be Felix Hernandez or Kyle Loebstein. I'll probably flip a coin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, did you enjoy the winning streak, at least?
Yes, that was fun. Nice.
It was unfortunate that it felt like a kind of pleasant surprise, just because I didn't really expect them to beat Chris Sale.
Yeah, I sort of pegged it at a 50-50 shot of them winning. Like, they were either going to win 1 out of 3 or 2 out of 3. That's, like, pretty much. There was, like, I pretty much pegged the Chris Sale start as, like, a guaranteed loss, which is not something you should do when predicting a baseball game, but, yeah, it was definitely a pleasant surprise to win all 3 games.
Well, as the great sage of the Yankees, John Sterling, says, you can't predict baseball, Susan.
Or as he said this afternoon, I can't really tell why teams win.
That's why analysis is here.
Yep.
Or my favorite is when he like brings up a stat and he's like, and what does that tell you? Nothing. And granted, sometimes a lot of those stats are just like extremely situational and actually do mean nothing because they're so small sample size. But I mean, there are some that he brings up where it's like, what is the point of this?
Yeah, it'll be like, so I think something today about like someone was batting like 0-for-10 against Price or something. It was something weird like that. He said something like someone was batting, I think it was Gardner. That was the whole argument with Gardner batting 8th or something.
Yeah, because Jeter hits well against Price, and Gardner has not. But, I mean, Jeter has at least been doing that in a much larger sample size. I mean, not a significant one, but Gardner's is only, as you said, like 10 at-bats or something like that.
Yeah, which actually does mean nothing.
My favorite are when, like, sometimes they're facing a reliever. It's like, he's faced him 4 times, and he has 2 hits.
So yeah, so that means he's going to... He's going to have a 400 isolated power for the rest of his career against this pitcher.
Yes. Yeah, that was very frustrating to see Brett Gardner. I mean, it was nice to see him back in the lineup after being injured, but it was really annoying to see him batting 8th, because that is definitely not where Brett Gardner should be batting in the year 2014, when he's been one of the best hitters on the Yankees.
He shouldn't have been batting 8th between the years 2010 and 2014, really.
No, probably not. Maybe in 2005.
And yet we saw him... Yeah, and yet we saw him bat 9th a decent amount of times, and that was sad.
No. Now he gets a promotion, because Girardi's like, you're better than Zealous Wheeler, kid.
Give him a pat on the back.
But yeah, I don't understand that. It's just I do understand that it's a very delicate line you're crossing when you're dealing with Derek Jeter, and he's Derek Jeter on the farewell tour, and it would create this crazy thing if he batted him anywhere other than leadoff or second. But I mean, feel like at some point you just got to do something to try to win the game. And yeah. Even though batting order isn't like the most important thing, it's damaging having a guy like Jeter who's been pretty disappointing this year, only WRC plus in like the 70s, and he's just like halting the rallies that are started by Jacoby Ellsbury before they even start normally.
Yeah, and the problem is that I think that a big problem with the offense is that there are a few good hitters, either by how they've performed or how we expect them to perform.
Brendan
Ellsbury's a good hitter. Brett Gardner's a good hitter. Prado's decent. Beltran should be good. You know, he's a bit of a question mark, but like Headley's pretty good. So the thing is, they have five or six decent hitters, but the sequencing has to be correct. And if you don't have proper sequencing, you get a hit and then double play immediately, or hit and then a strikeout, and then the rally's kind of dead. So although it doesn't have a huge effect, if you look at, you know, like Tom Tango's research, that could be a win over the course of a year, just in putting Jeter second.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not insignificant considering some of the acquisitions the Yankees made in the, at the trade deadline were like the equivalent of that. So getting like a Martin Prado or, you know, like a Brandon McCarthy may have only offset the difference between Derek Jeter batting second.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like Sunday, it really almost did cost them in because it was like bottom ninth, and I think Ellsbury was on first and ran into a double play with one out. And we went on to the 10th inning. They ended up winning, but like that literally could have cost them a win of him dribbling into a double play instead of doing anything else.
That sounds so very unlike Jeter.
But that's the thing. Like, Ellsbury got on with one out, and it's like, oh, watch Jeter have like a big moment, and everyone will say, like, why are we complaining about him batting second? Then he literally did the thing about Nellie just complaining about him batting second.
And it's like, oh.
Yeah.
Would he be surprised to learn that he leads the team and grounded his double plays this year?
I would be shocked. I wouldn't believe you.
He has 15.
I would not believe you. Well, he officially leads the Yankees career wise. I think he had at the beginning of the season.
I was gonna say, did they like do a ceremony to like? It's like for 72 years, this other guy has held the double plays record, but now it's Derek Jeter.
Well, it was Bernie Williams before him.
Okay, maybe not. For 8 years, maybe.
Yeah.
That surprises me a little bit, but I guess Bernie did play for them forever. So,
and you also have to consider that ground into a double play wasn't even counted, I think, before like the retro sheet era. So, So there's a lot of players who probably did ground into a double plays, especially in the dead ball era. Like I can only imagine how many there were,
mm-hmm.
but they just probably weren't counted.
I mean, even the bad counting stats are still going to be held by like good people because they've been around for a while.
Right.
Yes. You have to be around and play for a while to get up there.
Well,
yeah.
And the frustrating thing with the whole double play is that, you know, 2 years ago when Jeter had that great season in 2012 when he led the league in hits, he also grounded into 24 double plays, which tied a career high, but you don't notice it as much when he was like hitting, I don't want to say hitting for power because Jeter's never really been like a huge power hitter, but at least he had some semblance of slugging percentage. Like he was at .429 slugging in 2012, which just seems like a distant memory considering he has like nothing now.
Yeah, still the potential to hit doubles then.
Yes. He has one more grounded into double play than doubles.
Yeah. He's 13th all time in grounded into double play, which I thought it would be higher, to be honest.
Isn't Cal Ripken leading that one?
Cal Ripken is number one. 350 ground to double plays.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, he also played not 300 more games than Jeter, I think. Something like that.
Yeah, he did. I feel like Derek Jeter would pass if he played 300 more games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just this lineup construction just very irritating, and I don't... it's not like I expect, like, it's not like I'm saying, like, oh, well, Girardi shouldn't be there because another manager would do it. I doubt another manager would be pushing Jeter around to the lineup. It's just this weird, delicate thing that I don't know. they really should be, like, willing to at least have a conversation with him and say, like, hey, this isn't really the best for us right now.
Yeah.
If you haven't noticed, he kind of
it kind of runs, like, see, the thing is, we don't know really that much about Derek Jeter, to be honest. Mm-hmm. We really know, we probably know, like, nothing about him. Mm-hmm. But we do know that there is this, like, there are two sides to his coin. Because, you know, on the face of him, he's very much is a spokesperson for the team and for baseball, and is very much, like, quote-unquote team-oriented. But at the same time, he's also very narrative-oriented in terms of himself. Mm-hmm. Like, he has to market himself, and rightfully so, because he's a brand. Like, so he has to market himself like a brand. So when he does something like that, he probably has to struggle with the fact that you are branding yourself in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time as hurting your team. And in this particular case, he'll choose his own branding over the team. Maybe they haven't even brought it up. Maybe Joe Girardi just did this and never said anything about it. But it had to have been at least pondered.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to think so, but...
I mean, so, I don't even think it would be, like, Jeter throwing a fit. I just think, like, it would be... Like, before the game, Girardi would be introduced, and they would get, like, booed. Stuff like that, more than Jeter complaining.
Probably, yeah, because I don't think Jeter would be, like, when they batted Posada ninth and he threw a hissy fit. I don't think Jeter would do that.
Yeah.
No, he wouldn't, but he wouldn't be happy about it. Definitely would not be happy about it. And the fans would complain so much, and the media would be all over Joe Girardi. And they'd be like asking him what prompted you to, because I feel like if you don't do it from the beginning, you have to have a reason as to what prompted you to do that to begin with.
Yeah.
Like, okay, what was the turning point for you? You know, when did you realize that he's not capable to play to his full ability?
Yeah, I mean, this could have been nipped in the bud out of spring training when, you know, they had a pretty good lineup and they could have very easily put Jeter down toward like seventh or eighth maybe. Because, you know, they had guys like Ellsbury, Gardner, Beltran, McCann. It's good hitters that could all go up around one, two spots. But, nope.
They could have said, like, you got in, like, Ellsbury and all these guys, and they're, like, good top-of-the-order hitters, so we're going to put them there and probably could have gotten away with it then, but they started with Jeter, and now they're not able to get away with it.
Yep, kind of dug their own grave.
Yeah, I would just really be interested to see how much it affected the team. You'd have to, you know, do, like, a whole Markov chain and, like, figure out how that would have affected the team. But, you know, you have to say it would have affected the team marginally, especially when they're only out of the wild card. But what is it? You know, like a few games?
Yeah, like three and a half games at this point.
And, like, do you really want to lose the wild card by a game and there was an obvious change you could have made that wouldn't have required you to do anything except for move him in the lineup? So that's one thing I won't miss about the farewell tour, is that I guess the problem with the farewell tour is that players get preferential treatment regardless of how good they are, even though Cal Ripken did not.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it depends on the player, and I guess it also is different now because, like, again, the branding of the player is a little bit different.
Yep.
So
yeah, it's not all just Jeter. This lineup is good enough that they shouldn't really need Jeter to be performing at high levels to do well. So, I mean, that's what makes, like, two of the last three games. Obviously, it's very selective considering they scored 8 runs in an inning in this middle game. But, I mean, they were just very quiet. And, I mean, there's not really much you can do or Joe Girardi can do other than just keep running them out there. So.
Yeah, and just hope for the best.
I blame Blob.
Yes.
Blob for hitting coach.
What he'll do is hit the scrub.
Yeah. So I guess the question is in regards to the offense, and this is to address a ridiculous thing that people bring up, but I guess to an extent there's an underlying concern that's real. The question is, does the hitting coach actually affect the way hitters hit? And, I mean, me personally, I don't think Kevin Long really has, like, put a detriment to the team. as much as people would like to blame him for it. But do you think that the team would maybe scapegoat him for the team not doing well, or maybe there actually is something he did that caused the team to stop hitting? I don't know.
I mean, I tend to think that hitting coaches, pitching coaches, they're just the easy person to blame. But they're not the ones that are like out there swinging the bat, throwing the pitches. So even though I think Kevin Long has lost some of his luster over the past few years, now, I mean, not entirely through his own fault. I mean, Yankees have had some pretty crappy offenses the past 2 years. But, I mean, they could very well make him out to be a scapegoat. Just if they are looking for someone to blame, I can't imagine how Steinbrenner's too happy that his money isn't really going to a good place right now. So they could do something, but...
Yeah.
They also seem to like him a lot, but maybe that's changed.
Maybe. I guess the follow-up to that would be, like, how would you even know if he was doing something? Like, how would a fan even know if he had any effect? I mean, I guess the one example of a pitching coach is the fact that the Yankees and the pitching coaches and the people who studied the pitching of Brandon McCarthy knew about his cutter and had an intuition that it would help him. But unless, you know, a team releases that and says something, how would you even know that he said anything? How would you know that Kevin Long even did anything?
Right.
Because hitters are constantly making adjustments. But
yep.
I don't know if it even affected it more. Maybe it did. I don't know. But I'm inclined to think that it is entirely not to do with that. It's partially luck.
Like when you hear these stories of like, oh, this player's been working with a hitting coach. That story's usually around for like the 2 days, and then like for that player goes right back into a slump. It's not like you really hear about that he's been working with a hitting coach.
Or like, yeah, he made a tweak, and now he's excelling.
I think the point of that is, which is the fair point, is that it's hard to tell when a player is doing well because they made a tweak and because it was just some random variation and whatever. They could just, you know, BABIP their way into a good streak. But yeah, I think the whole point is that if you have like a projection of how a player is going to be, like a quote-unquote true talent level, the assumption with the true talent level is that they're constantly adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if they never adjusted, their true talent level would technically go down because pitchers kept adjusting to them and they never adjusted back.
Yeah. I guess I wish I had like a better answer than like, we'll see, but I guess the only person who really knows how Steinbrenner is feeling about Kevin Long is Hal Steinbrenner.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe Brian Cashman is starting too. But then again, I guess Brian Cashman needs to figure out if he's coming back too, but we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the team will figure out how to get that hitting again that they were doing during that five-game winning streak. That was a lot of fun to watch. And they have a big series coming up in Toronto this weekend against the Blue Jays. Then they'll play three against the Red Sox at Yankee Stadium. And considering where the Red Sox are at this point, they should really roll over them like they did with the White Sox. But we'll see if that actually happens.
I don't trust them with that. I just don't. No. I don't care that the Red Sox are bad. It doesn't even matter.
No, yeah, they're still going to play them hard. So,
yep. So,
and it's not easy to overcome like multi-game deficits in September. I know that 3.5 games isn't terribly large, but it's still going to overcome not just the wild card teams there right now, but also the Tigers and Mariners are tied in there too. So,
yeah.
Well,
they would like to win 90 games. They'd have to go like 21-9. And they've never gone, like, you know, more than, like, 8 games over 500 this year. So that doesn't tell you everything you need to know. They have to play better than they have played all year and go on some sudden crazy run.
So you're saying there's a chance?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. Like, look, there have been crazier things.
Yep.
Look at the way the Rays got in the wild card. Look at the way the Rockies got in the wild card in 2007.
Or how the like the
things
Mets
have happened apart,
when the Mets fell apart in 2007 too, and the Phillies snuck in.
Yeah. Good teams fall apart out of nowhere, and bad teams get good out of nowhere. and somehow make it to the World Series. 2006 Cardinals.
I would support going to the World Series. I know this is a hot take, but
I would, but at the same time, it would just feel like I would feel like I'm cheating.
Whatever. The 2000 Yankees apologized for nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
And even though 2001 was pretty good, too, they had no business being in there over the 116-win Mariners.
Yeah. Ultimate, that was, like, one of the best teams ever.
Ultimate troll job.
Yeah. 2001 Mariners were one of the greatest teams ever, and they didn't make it to the World Series.
The Yankees of the late 90s, early 2000s were, like, for all pretty excellent trolls.
Except for 98, I guess.
Yeah.
They were also pretty damn good in 99 as well. I think they won like 99 games or something like that.
Yeah, they did.
Well, even 98 is like they're throwing the lead over how good they are.
Yeah, that's true.
You also have to consider that in that period of time, the AL East wasn't what it was now. Like now it's kind of packed. Like there are a bunch of teams that are decent. Like the Rays, if you played them, you were basically like beating up on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in 98 when they were like 55 games.
Yes, the Quentin McCracken era. Bring it back. Well, that was also when, like, I think it was something crazy, like 6 years in a row, the American League East standings were exactly the same with, like, Yankees 1, Red Sox 2, Jays 3, Orioles 4, Devil Rays 5.
Yes, that's what it was for many years. Yeah.
And the Orioles were just losers from 1998 until 2011, and then they won. And then they got the wild card in 12, and they've been good since then. So now, like, you're dealing
with
multiple very good teams, whereas like then the Yankees just had to deal with mostly just the Red Sox and the Orioles before them, and they were actually good at the casino and stuff.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I don't know. Like, if they had the same team they have now, I don't know what would have happened if they were in that situation, in that same type of setup. But you have to consider that, yeah, they were playing some very bad teams. Very, very bad teams. Maybe it was just because the talent wasn't as spread out, and maybe it is now, or I don't know. But, yeah, they have definitely more competition, and those teams were very good, but luck definitely plays into it. It has to.
They also had more grit.
That's
intangibles. They had heart.
Yes, except you couldn't. They had heart, but you couldn't predict if they would win the next year with it. But other than that, you could tell it was there.
Actually, it was really funny on Twitter the other day. Some guy was yelling at the Pinstripe Alley account that. It's like, what's the difference between Paul O'Neill and Derek Jeter? And it's like, guts. I'm like, I don't really know what you're trying to say.
There was a funny article, I think maybe at the beginning of the season, by Russell Carlton about team chemistry, and that most teams at the beginning of the year said how great their team chemistry was.
Mm-hmm.
And would brought and sort of and like, but yet you were not able to tell. You were not able to tell which ones actually were going to be good or bad based off of what their chemistry was. So it's usually very good looking back on the team and saying they worked well together because they won. They had fun because they were winning.
Yeah, just had like a loose clubhouse, and you know, it was totally enabled by the fact they were winning all the time.
Yeah, I think that was a very good quote by Jim Leland, who said, you know what team chemistry is? An effing 300 batting average. Unless you're Ben Revere.
Like, I don't doubt there are people who, like, are good at, like, keeping everyone loose and happy, but it's not like a lack of those guys sort of, like, gonna make it, like, a good team have bad chemistry. Like, if you're winning, you're still going to get along fine if you don't like the other person because you're winning.
Yeah, I mean, you may not like them off the field. I just don't know how that correlates to what you do on the field. Like, when I get on the field, am I, like, distracted, or does my performance not meet up to par because I'm like, oh, man, you know, screw that guy. He really pissed me off before.
He took the last
like, does it affect you that much?
Apparently. Either way, I think one thing that would improve their team chemistry is if they got Masahiro Tanaka back, because he's a good pitcher.
And that generally helps the team and winning games.
Sometimes. And then again, Hiroki Kuroda pitched well today, and they're just like, no. And he's like, really, guys? Got 9 straight hits yesterday, and you're just like, no? They're like, nope.
It's a typical Kuroda start.
Seriously. So Tanaka did throw off a mound today at Tiger Stadium, or Comerica Park, and faced some of the Yankees hitters, and Yankees are pretty encouraged by his results. Some writers have speculated that he could return on September 12th, which I think seems a little ambitious, but sounds like they're growing more and more optimistic that we could possibly see him in September.
That would make me happy.
God.
I don't know how much it would actually help. It would help more. It would help a decent amount.
It'd help morally.
Yeah, I guess it would just feel good knowing that he's healthy and that he could come back next year healthy.
Yeah, even if like his starts at the major league level are just kind of like test things just to see how he's going.
Yeah, 85 pitches, maybe you'll throw 5 innings, 6 yeah. innings, and then...
Tanaka's be like, what? You want me to leave the game in the 6th? I don't do that.
Honestly, at this point with Tanaka, I'm not going to hope stuff until I actually see him on the mound.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, there's so many times where, like, you know, you've tracked people rebounding from injury, and it's like, oh, he's making these great steps. He's on his way back, and then it's like, oh, setback.
Yeah. If he feels any pain, like, he's done.
Oh, yeah, they're just going to be like, nope, shutting it down.
But I will say one thing that I think is encouraging, that it looks like, knock on every piece of wood that I own or have seen in my life, that it looks like he's going to avoid major surgery, considering that he's reacted very well to the treatment.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because I think that if if there had been a major setback early on and the ligament hadn't repaired itself a little bit, maybe you'd feel that he would have surgery. But I think now it looks I'm pretty confident in the fact he'll be back next year and won't have to get surgery.
Right.
Which is really the most important thing. That you know, coming back this year is really nominal compared to that.
Especially since the Yankees are kind of facing a long shot at the playoffs this year. So, in this case, it would be like a last-ditch effort. But at least if you're planning for 2015, then you're at least trying to put your stock into a new season, maybe.
Yeah. So, you did some research on the platelet-rich plasma.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly was the timeline of how long the ligament lasted after the treatment? Like, I believe it was Wainwright had to have surgery eventually, but that was like years later.
Yeah.
Were there any pitchers that like immediately had surgery right after they were done with their treatment?
I mean, oftentimes you'll find, at least at the major league level, one of the reasons people are so skeptical of the platelet-rich plasma therapy is that a lot of times players have gotten the therapy and then it wasn't really reacting, so then they went for the Tommy John surgery. But it seems like, I don't remember the last time, maybe this is just confirmation bias because I haven't looked specifically and very thoroughly at when exactly each of these other pitchers were receiving platelet-rich plasma treatment and when they ended up getting the surgery, but I don't recall a pitcher reacting to it as well as Tanaka has, at least at the major league level.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely incorrect. It could be partially maybe his age. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, being 20, like, you're going to repair your body. Like, your body's going to repair itself much easier when you're 25 than when you're 30.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be part, you know, I don't know. But again, like Matt said, it's not over yet, and there could be any setback that could push that back. Because if it even tears a little bit, like if it goes beyond 10% even more, that could be serious.
Yeah, definitely.
So
and as mentioned, Tanaka's tear was much smaller than the tears of like Ivanova, Matt Harvey last year, and all these other pitchers that have gone for Tommy John surgery.
it wasn't nearly torn as much, so that made them decide, well, maybe this is a worthwhile endeavor. So we'll see. And you can pitch to the partially torn UCL if it's not torn that much. I think Adam Wainwright was pitching with a partially torn UCL for like 5 years, and some of those seasons were pretty elite. Granted, we don't know how the exact percentage of the tear, but still.
Yes, we can only hope for Adam Wainwright level performance.
Yes, I would accept Tanaka performing at Wainwright levels.
I want to know.
For a number of years.
Man, imagine getting like a season where you would have both Pineda and Tanaka going for a while, and then it'd be very nice to watch.
That would be cool. And if Shane Green actually is a person that can be watched.
Yeah, man, he's looked great. Did well against the Tigers for a second.
I mean, if he's good, I mean, I still have my doubts, obviously, about him. I like the stuff. Some of it's a little fringy, but, like, the slider's real. The fastball has some life to it. But the thing is, if he's a decent pitcher, then that saves the Yankees a little. Like, it just cuts so much slack from them in the offseason. Because they were, you know, really going to have to replace, like, Hiroki Kuroda if he doesn't come back, or if they don't re-sign Brandy McCarthy. Like, they will have an obvious hole that he could fill. And even if they do decide to get, you know, McCarthy back and Nova comes back later in the year, then you're just going to have so much more depth that, like, this year they needed a lot of depth. And they had it, luckily. So... Yeah. I'm really hoping that this is not just a fluke, because he would just be a nice cost-controlled arm they would have for, you know, quite a few more years, and that would be a nice change of scenery.
Yeah, I could go for a nice young arm in the rotation, but I predict that they're going to go after one of those big free agent starters anyway, even if Green is spectacular in September, just because they don't want to bet too much on him, because, you know, Ivan Nova was pretty spectacular down the stretch, too, and, you know, he might have very well continued it, but he tore his UCL, so thanks, baseball 2014.
Well, try pitching with the other arm.
Yeah.
That'll solve it.
Speaking of pitching with the other arm, that can bring us to September call-up candidates, is we are surprisingly nearing the end of August. Really kind of snuck up, but today is August 28th, and by the time this post goes up, it'll be the 29th. August is almost over, and September will come soon, and the Yankees will have their rosters expand. And there might be some players in the minors that they could call up, including Pat Venditti, who Grant Brisby wrote about today on SB Nation. And he pitches with both arms, which is kind of quirky, but that's all he really has going for him. He has nice numbers, but it seems kind of unlikely that he'll get a shot.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just don't understand the upset. I know that Pat Venditti is like an interesting character, but I just don't understand the obsession with him. Like, people see this, like, stat line that he has, but from everything you read about him, like, people who have seen him play, like, nobody's impressed.
Yeah, he's kind of a soft tosser. That's the thing.
You know, nobody feels that his stuff is going to translate to the big league level. And I think it's just because, like, when you don't have enough access to video of minor league players, it's very hard to see anything other than the stat line. And then you just start drawing conclusions from what you see in the stat line. You sort of make your own version of them in your head. Mm-hmm. But there are plenty of players who can do well in the minors, and they just will physically not be able to play in Major League Baseball, no matter how good they are in the minors, because their stuff just doesn't translate. And from everything I read about Pat Venditti, just isn't good enough to be a good Major League Baseball player. And it's unfortunate, because that's an interesting thing to have a switch pitching pitcher, but if they're not good, why would you bother?
Yeah, I mean, I would be curious enough to give him a shot at as a September call-up and try him in low-leverage situations just to see how he would do, because I find him more, at least a little bit more intriguing than the likes of Rich Hill.
I mean, yeah, I'd rather see Venditti than like the seventh edition of the Daily Show. But
but the thing is with that is, I make a presumption that the Yankees are pretty good at analyzing their own talent, and they probably know more. They definitely know more than we do about their minor league talent. It really says something when you go out and get, I think they just got Josh Outman from the Indians.
Ooh.
And they got Rich Hill and Wade LeBlanc and, you know, Rick and all these guys and Jeff Francis, these guys who you would not want on your team. And they are valued higher than Pat Van Diddy.
Mm-hmm.
How would then I think? How, they obviously don't, which means that they obviously do not think highly of him. If they would rather go out of the organization and get someone who's clearly a replacement level player, which then the next assumption is that they assume that Pat Van Diddy is below a replacement level player.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's the only thing that I can draw from that.
I mean, it could also be a thing where they're worried about service time and all that, too. That's always...
But he's, like, 30.
Yeah.
They're worried about paying him a free agent salary when he's, like, 36.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of curious just to imagine how he would do. I'm not really a huge fan of his, but I don't know. I do understand what you're saying about how, like, if they really value him so little, then why are they going out of the organization? But I just don't see how he could be any worse than the likes of, you know, Richard.
I feel like they can be. I feel like that type of stuff that surprises you. Like, I don't think people realize how bad a pitcher could be if you just bring them up and they're not good at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Yankees are good at not doing that. And, like, if he comes in, like, and he's absolutely dreadful. And here's the other thing. He could come in and not be dreadful and still be a dreadful player because relief pitchers can still look good even though they're not. So he could give you nominal innings and look okay, and then people will think he's great. But so was Preston Claiborne.
Ah, the Preston Claiborne era.
So I have a lot of doubts about him. I mean, yeah, maybe he surprises everybody. I don't know. That'd be cool. But when you're 29 years old, you don't become 29 years old in AAA because you're a good pitcher and nobody knew about you.
Unless you're Vidal Nuno, then you're the future.
Yeah, because if you think about it, he's been Rule 5 eligible and he hasn't been taken, correct?
Yeah, he was Rule 5 eligible last year. No one took him. Grant mentioned that in his article too.
Yeah, I mean, so everyone's really not like, yeah, everyone, no one really wants to take a wave on him. And everyone can't be wrong.
I think Shane Green was also Rule 5 eligible, and he wasn't clamped. Maybe that was someone else. I remember they were talking about some guy who's done stuff for the Yankees this year was Rule 5 eligible before the season, and no one claimed him.
It may have been, like, Whitley or something.
Yeah, I think that's who you're talking about. I think it was Whitley.
But I mean, there's like guys like Solarte where they are career minor leaguers and they have like a month that's just like great.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not any better than they actually were, but they just like had one good month to propel them to, you know, a short little stint in the majors, and maybe that's what Van Diddy would do. But the thing is, people who evaluated Solarte weren't really wrong about him. Like, he's still a career minor leaguer, even though he played one season in Major League Baseball. And he was, like, okay for a period of time.
Mm.
So a lot of times, I think in this case, you kind of have to trust the crowd a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, under the assumption that they know a lot more about him, about Van Diddy, than we do. But it depends if he's, like, it depends on how far in the depth chart he's on. And who else they want to bring up and what ratio of bats versus arms they want to bring up. I don't know.
Yep.
But he certainly wouldn't be my first choice. He would not be my first choice.
No. I'd like to see the strikeout factory.
That would be my first choice.
Bring me Jacob Lindgren. I'm tired of seeing him rack up high strikeout stats every night in the minor league recap. And then it's like, I mean, I know he's walking some people too, but it'd be interesting to see him at the major league level. It sounds like it's a possibility, but
I mean, it happens with plenty of, like, they're like good, very, very good pitchers that are close to the major league level, like, do make September call-ups. Like, that happened with Chris Sale. Like, he did that. I'm not saying that he's Chris Sale, but it's happened before. There's like rumors that that's going to happen with Carlos Rodon this year. Like, it happens, and like from everything I'm reading, everyone sort of agrees that he's major league ready now.
Yeah, and they say like his slider is a major league pitch. So
yes, and if I'm not mistaken, the September call-up does not count against service time, right?
No, I don't think so.
So they could call him up and, you know, give him a cup of coffee, and then if he needs more time, they know that going into next year.
Yep.
And then maybe if they know it and he's good enough, then they can have him on the roster to start the season next year.
Yep.
Saying that I've already forgotten that Jeff Francis played for the Yankees.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't forget. I'm like an elephant with the last arm on the roster.
Well, I mean, one of the new last arms on the roster is now Josh Atman, apparently, who is not exciting.
No.
I just quickly went to his Fangraph page, and he has a 3.28 ERA, which isn't bad, but he's also walked almost 6 per 9 innings.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, he's another lefty guy, so maybe he's like a loogie.
Yeah, they just like hope to get one good outing out of him, and then once he's bad, they cut him.
Yeah. Again, I'd rather just see Lindgren.
Yes, would endorse.
Okay, so in 2014, lefties are hitting 180, 293, 380 against him. So,
Well, he'd be good against righties, too.
No, I'm not talking about Lindgren. I'm talking about Outman.
Oh, okay.
You're like, oh, who gives a shit? No, Outman is not exciting. I guess he's just another one of those Rich Hill.
Rich Hill, Jeff Francis.
Yeah, wait, they're combined.
Jeff Hill LeBlanc.
Oh, Wade LeBlanc. You had such a glorious start at the Angels, and then you were gone because you were not Garrett Richards. Somehow. But other call-up candidates, Tyler Webb got rocked pretty hard the other day in AAA, but he still has pretty good numbers on the season, so he's another relief candidate. They're probably going to bring up another catcher, and whether that's Murphy or Romine is really up for debate. I don't really know. It's probably a toss-up, but...
They'll definitely bring up Chris Young.
Oh, probably, yeah. I don't know why they would sign him to a minor league contract now if they didn't want to at least think about calling him up in September.
Yeah, so that's going to happen.
Sorry, Zoilo, but you weren't exciting either.
Former Yankee top prospect.
Yeah, hey, he just needs 500 plate appearances, you know.
He needs more time.
Yeah. Like, I understand people wanting to be patient with prospects, but Zoilo wasn't really much of a prospect.
Yeah, he was like, his ceiling was a 45.
It's like, did he want to give David Adams 500 plate appearances?
No, I wanted to give him 5. I still remember, as clear as day, like, there was that one week where David Adams was good.
Oh, it was great, yeah.
And I still remember on the Yes Network, Michael Kay was talking about how it looks like David Adams had been playing for years. And that he looked like such an experienced player, and like immediately he pooped. He pooped out.
David Adams did not know how to walk.
Alright, and then we're like, oh wait, he hasn't walked yet. And then like 2 weeks later, he still hasn't walked yet. And then he was dead.
And like, even Zoilo had an exciting first couple weeks, and then it's just like, nah. So, I don't think, going back to call-ups, I have a feeling that even though Ref Snyder's had a pretty great season, I don't think he's going to be coming up. I don't get the vibe that they're going to do so. Which is a little disappointing, but whatever. I'm not in charge of their roster management.
No. Maybe some people are talking about Perella, but again, it's like the same thing. I feel like the same way about Perella as I do Venditti.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his numbers are kind of good, but, like, he's been in the minors for a while, and he's always been hitting, like, okay. But, like, no one ever really thinks he's that good. You know, he has, like, a low walk rate, and his strikeouts will probably be higher. He doesn't really have much power, And, like, his offense is completely predicated on hitting for average.
Mm.
Which I don't know if he would even do at the major league level.
And there's a good article posted at Over the Monster the other day. It's talking about how it seems like it's getting harder for players from AAA to make it up to the majors because it seems like the talent gap is widening. And that's one of the reasons why I see a guy like Jackie Bradley Jr., who I like to mock a lot, but he did have like a 137 WRC plus last year in AAA in 80 games. And he's just been terrible at the major league level.
Yeah.
So even though like guys like Corella can have nice numbers, if the guy just doesn't really have a great skill set, then it's hard to really be too invested in it.
I'm more excited about AA numbers, to be honest, than AAA numbers.
Yeah, I can buy that.
AAA, a lot of them are like career minor leaguers and like guys who are just kind of fading away, like the Kei Igawas of the world.
Like when we went, Greg and longtime listener went to that Rare Riders game, not this week, but last week. Two players that were in Syracuse, which is who they were playing, lineup were Brandon Laird and Greg Dobbs.
Oh, good.
It really does, like, stat lines mean nothing in the minor leagues, and, like, people try to make a story out of them, and then they're really nothing. So, I try to just ignore them. Unless I see that in conjunction with other people who had seen them in person.
Mm.
And, like, felt, okay, they're like Ref Snyder. The beginning, I was kind of iffy because, like, no one really knew him. And, you know, he was hitting well, but, like, no one really felt he was that toolsy. But then when people started noticing, they realized, like, okay, the bat's major league ready. Like, there's, like, double confirmation there.
Right.
Most of these guys, like Perella and stuff, like, how do you even know? Unless you're like in a talent evaluator, like how would you know if this guy's good enough?
Yeah. So, even though it's fun to talk about September call-ups, I just don't get a sense we're going to get anyone that exciting, which is kind of a bummer.
No. Yeah.
Maybe next year. Hopefully next year, maybe Ref Snyder will just start the year at the major league level. I can dream.
Yes, that would be ideal.
I think we've talked about all of our topics.
Yeah, I think we have.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Sean Kelly horsehead was weird. It was funny while it lasted.
It was a thing.
Then he got destroyed by Alex Avila, and it wasn't as funny. All right. I guess we'll move on to the tweet bag. First question. From PC_retro. Question. Do you guys think Griardi is a good manager? Well, I know Griardi has great managing experience, but I just don't trust him to make the Red Durger moves, you know.
But yeah, he does have good Blaplan Majaminen.
Girardi is like Girardi's evil twin. It's like Community, the alternate timeline. He like has a beard.
Or it's Bizarro World, like in the Bizarro Seinfeld universe.
Yeah. Bizarro Jerry says hello when he's leaving the room, says goodbye when he's entering. But to get to the actual crux of the question, I think Girardi's fine.
Yeah, there are things that I just think like any manager is gonna have those that thing like any manager that you'd hire.
Yeah, like not
agree with every movie made.
Yeah, like the problem today of not pitching David Robertson in this game, even though it was a tie game late, and you know you don't really want to worry about saves at that point, and you kind of just want your best pitchers in. So you know I would have gone David Robertson, but very few managers around the game are really gonna do that move. So. It's just kind of an annoying universal truth that you just have to kind of swallow.
Yes. I guess the only thing that most people have to compare to is Joe Torre. And I think that the proper comparison would be that Joe Torre was better when it came to off-the-field player management. And Joe Girardi is better with the on-the-field decision-making. Not to say that Girardi's perfect with that, but I think that his strategies are definitely better than Joe Torre's.
Yeah.
Yep.
He doesn't bunt at stupid times. His lineup is generally, other than two Hulk claws, is generally pretty good. His bullpen management is great. And in terms of off the field, I think it's serviceable. And I think especially with the whole A-Rod fiasco last year, he was able to deflect as much attention as he could.
Mm-hmm.
While a lot of managers, I feel like, could have easily, like, screwed that up.
Yeah. He just kind of, like, accepted. He's like, yep, we're just going to play him. See what happens. I'm going to scream at Ryan Dempster a little bit.
Yeah.
So, I think he's fine. It's all, like, the enemy you know is better than the enemy you don't know. And I just think Girardi is pretty reliable. He's not, like, the reason they're losing. So.
Absolutely not, no.
Yeah, and if you, like, go through all the teams, like, how many would you, like, straight up swap with? Like, I don't know, I can't think of, like, any.
Give me Ryan Sandberg.
Maybe, like, Bob Melvin would be, like, the only one that I could...
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Like, even, like, most managers don't really affect the outcome of the game. Like, bias. They're either really, really bad, they don't have much effect, or they're amazing. You know? Very few managers have, like, this significant impact on the outcome of the game. So.
Let's say I certainly don't want Kirk Gibson.
Oh, yeah. No. Steve, he can stay in Arizona. Or be fired. next question from Greg Kirkland.
Fired.
From Greg Kirkland. How many tacos can you eat? I enjoy tacos, so I could eat several tacos.
I could eat a lot of tacos if I really wanted to.
I normally eat two, but as far as how many I could eat, like six. Like, if you're talking actually I could, like, physically do, like six.
I'd say around 5-6 tacos. Maybe 8 if I really, like, didn't eat before and I pushed myself.
Well, maybe we need to do a live, was it Dola Thrilla, where the people were eating, like, the Doritos Locos tacos.
Yes. I gotta do, like, 2 of those and then I'd be done.
So yes, we could all eat tacos. I don't know if I can put a quantity on it, but if Greg wants to challenge us all to eat as many tacos and pay for it, then we'll partake. Next question from Sean McNeil. Prospect you're most excited to see during the September call up. I would like to see Lindgren.
Him, but as far as the ones that are likely, I guess Murphy.
Yeah, it's kind of slim pickings.
Yeah, I'd really like Lindgren, but other than that, I'm really care less.
I'm excited for this outfield prospect, Chris Young. I'm excited to see how this guy who couldn't hack out the Mets does in September with the Yankees.
What could go wrong?
Now, the thing is, like, it's mostly September call-ups. If any of them end up seeing significant playing time, then something's going wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, next question. If you guys were all together in the same room while recording this podcast and you decide to get a pizza, what topic would you go with? This is, again, from Greg Kirkland.
I think Greg is hungry.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, what kind of pizza do you like? Yeah, we'll go around and say our favorite pizzas.
My go-to is ham and bacon.
It's pretty good.
Ham and bacon. There's this one slice of pizza at my local pizza place called the Chicken Bomber, which has, like, 2 different types of cheese, chicken, bacon, and I think, like, Russian dressing or something like that.
Huh. That's complex. I like it.
It's complex, and it doesn't, like, sound great because it's, like, on a slice of pizza, but it's actually amazing. And they also make it into heroes, too.
My old reliable is always buffalo chicken. That's me. So if we were getting a pizza, I don't know. I feel like we all would probably just kind of sit around and be kind of indecisive and be like, okay, I guess we'll just get this one.
Yeah, probably.
We'll just get regular.
Yeah, well, see, like, the thing is, I feel like none of us would be like, oh, I'm not gonna eat that kind of pizza, probably.
Yeah.
Unless it was, like, something, like, intentionally obnoxious, like anchovies.
Pineapple and anchovies.
Oh my god. Those tastes do not go together. I know what pizza Greg would not take. That would be ketchup and hot dogs pizza.
I'd have to agree with him there. Ketchup and hot dogs need to be thrown into the pit of hell.
No, and you take your, it's like a, your pizza is like a Chicago deep dish pizza. You wrap it up over the hot dog, and then you eat
it. With ketchup on it.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh. Yeah. It's like that SNL Taco Town commercial. It's just worse. Damn it, Greg, you're making me hungry. From Matt Ferencik, how long until Andrew catches that ghost that turns off his mic at night? Greg says car phone, and that is correct. I've been having mic problems, and it's really great. My mic decides, yeah, it's not going to work for a while. So I'll do it for the tweet bag. We move on now to Matt F's B-Ref segment.
What I did this week is I went essentially by the split finder on B-Ref's play index, and I decided to sort by position, and I found the players with the best and worst OPS with a minimum of 300 plate appearances. Guess who, like, the best and worst are for the Yankee career. Some of them are kind of interesting, especially the best ones, because they're not heated spec, because it's okay. Kind of a low minimum.
Okay.
So, if we start with catcher, the worst one probably won't be able to get it. It's from 86 to 88.
Mm.
It's Joel Skinner, who hit a sterling 213, 251, 298, for a 549 OPS.
Ouch.
But
hmm.
If we go through the highest, not Edith Svet, do you guys know who it is?
And it's not going to be like Posada?
No, it's not.
Is it somebody like random?
I'll put it this way, it's fairly recently.
Is it not Jesus Montero?
No, you wouldn't make it with that minimum. It's 300, minimum of 300 also.
Yeah, it's 300.
It isn't Russ, is it?
No, he is, well, I have it sorted from worst to best, and he's 13th, so that would be 12th best time.
Alright. I'm stumped if it's fairly recently.
Mike Stanley?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yep.
Yeah. Good hitter.
291. He hit 291, 520 for a Yankee career.
Pretty good. They replaced him with Joe Girardi.
Who's ninth worst?
Yes.
By the way, the top three for worst catchers, it goes Joel Skinner, Chris Stewart, Jose Molina.
Of course.
So
I was gonna say John Flaherty and fifth. Stewart. Yeah.
John Flaherty and his epic playing career that we always hear about on Yes.
Okay, so now if we go to first base, again the worst probably no guys yet, because it's the immortal Johnny Sturm. Who played one season in 1941 and hit 239, 293, 300.
Wow, that is atrocious for a first baseman.
A solid three home runs.
Hmm.
Yikes.
And he played 124 games.
Jeez.
Yikes. I'm guessing number one is Garrett. Would that be a stretch?
No. I don't know if I messed something up, but he is actually not on this list even, so I probably did mess something up.
Yeah, because he had, like, an OPS of, like, something really high. his career OPS was 1,080.
Yeah, okay.
Would that be number one?
It would. I don't know why he's not on here then. Yeah, this is totally a bust, because I have no idea what's happening with these lists. They looked fine to me earlier, but sorry, I opened them. They're like,
I think I could find it on Fangraphs.
Yeah, you probably can.
Let me see if I can get it on Fangraphs. Probably be the easier way.
All the worst ones seem pretty legit, but
yeah. Okay, here we go. So, let's do. All right, so catcher should be the same. Mike Stanley is still the best. Joel Skinner is the worst.
One's legit.
Okay. Yeah, Gehrig is the best for first base, obviously. And then the worst is Johnny Sturm, is what you said before. So that's right. Okay. So now for second base, number one is Ernie Johnson, I think. Let me see. Yeah, Ernie Johnson is number one, actually. He had 356 plate appearances. So, and he just beat out Cano by 9 points. Even though Cano's park adjusted number is better, but still pretty fun.
Hmm.
And then the lowest is Lute Boone. His name is spelled L-U-T-E.
Ah, like the instrument.
Yes, 544 OPS. Then Joe Gideon, Sandy Alomar, Enrique Wilson.
Enrique Wilson would have been a good guess. Yeah.
Yes, so that's definitely a good one. Okay, so...
Apparently this just turned into Matt P. Fangraphs. So.
it'll get the same.
Yeah.
Well, this is weird Fangraph stuff now. For shortstop, number one is actually Ernie Johnson again.
Sure. Ernie Johnson is not only the plumber in your building, but he's also a former Yankee.
Yeah, Jeter would be the real one, in my opinion. And I kind of want to throw Ernie Johnson's out, even though it's 356, but it comes up as second base and shortstop. Oh, boy. I want you to guess the lowest one's the funniest. The lowest OPS for a shortstop in Yankee history is the greatest one.
Is it Nunez?
No. No. Okay. Okay, the lowest is Ruben Amaro.
Oh, Rube.
And just to throw in another GM, Gene Michaels 8.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's actually Ruben Amaro's dad.
I think it is.
Yeah.
That's great though.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so third base now. The one that leads should be pretty easy.
Some Rodriguez fella.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, he
number
was
two. Right. The number two is Eric Soderholm, and then Wade Boggs. Bottom of the list is pretty funny. It's
Vernon,
recent.
Vernon Wells, third baseman.
No, because it's 300 plate appearances. So Nunez is 18th, but number one is pretty. You know him.
Is it Ramiro?
Ramiro. Yeah. So
it is Ramiro Pena.
Yes.
Bobby Cox is fifth. Right behind Ramiro Pena is Celerino Sanchez.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, right field, come on.
Actually, you know who was super high on third base for me? It was Aaron Chavez.
Huh. Yes, it was high on mine as well. Number one for right field is the Ruth character.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
He was
and
okay.
Funny enough, number two is George Selkirk. Selkirk also wore number three.
Yeah, he was the guy that came after Ruth. He's like, no pressure.
He was not bad.
No, he wasn't bad at all.
I actually have a baseball at home. It's signed by like three other players who also wore number three.
Huh.
Just a weird little thing. And George Selkirk is one of them. It's like missing two of them though, so it's not like as valuable as it could be. All right. Bottom of the list is
I figured Bill out Robinson. What's wrong. I figured out what I messed up. Or I didn't mess it up. Apparently for the split one, it only goes back to 1954.
Okay. Well, that'll do it.
Yeah. Well, it's almost done. There's only like three left now.
It was good in theory.
Bottom of the list for right fielder is Bill Robinson at a 582 OPS.
Hmm.
Let's see. Felipe Alou is 16th. Ichiro Suzuki is 12th.
Hey, he is our best hitter.
All right.
Said that one guy.
Center field.
Actually, I want to see this.
Center field is tied.
Is it tied between Mansell and DiMaggio?
Yes, it is. Even though their WRC plus is different.
Yeah.
Much higher for Mantle.
You have DiMaggio in first.
It technically does put DiMaggio in first, even though it shouldn't.
It's weird for just... On this one, according to this, he only played in field for one team, but I don't even know if that's true. I don't know what's happening with BRF tonight.
And then last on the list is Bill Robinson again. I don't know. I guess
he was really bad.
Yeah,
Bill Robinson. He was. He was not Ernie Johnson. Let's be real, or whatever the guy's name.
Okay, left field.
Yeah, dynamic 3-4.
I'm gonna throw out Babe Ruth. I feel like should not be.
I mean, he played both left and right, so
he did.
Yeah.
And then number two is Charlie Keller.
Keller was good. They're in the ring.
Ben Selkirk and then Ben Paschal and then Bob Musil, Ricky Henderson 7th, you know, the usual characters. Winfield is 10th, Matsui is 11th. David Justice snuck in there. Dan Pasqua, actually, 23rd.
That's it.
23rd with a 728 OPS is Ping Bodhi.
Ping Bodhi.
Okay, let's go to the lowest. The lowest is Tony Womack.
Of course.
And Vernon Wells is 3rd.
Legend.
Yeah. Okay, and now for the last one is DH, which is going to be more recent. Number 1 is Jason Giambi.
Yep.
To the surprise of no one. And bottom of the list is Carlos May.
Sucks to suck, Carlos May.
A 674 OPS from 536 plate appearances at DH.
Whoops.
That'll do it.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
He actually had a decent career, though, Carlos May. This was at the tail end. He played pretty well for the White Sox for, like, a good 5-6 years.
Do we know how his farewell tour went?
The presents are still in the mail.
Did they insist on batting him high in the lineup, even though he's declined?
I don't think so.
I guess that'll conclude the kind of BREF segment.
Fangraph segment.
Yeah, I'll light BREF on fire.
Okay, well, we can just move on to the Yankee and the Mitre of the Week. Matt F., your Yankee of the Week.
My Yankee of the Week is Jacoby Ellsbury because he has gone nuts this week.
Oh, yes, he has. Dingers!
So every time we do the Yankee and Mitre of the Week, I normally bring up Fangraph stats for the past week, and according to that, Fangraph's in the past week, he has put up 0.7 war. Last week alone.
That's one way to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Matt P., your Yankee of the Week.
Mine would have to be Martin Prado for going almost insane. He's, like, not Ellsbury level, but still great. And people were complaining about how he wasn't hitting, and now it seems like he's positively regressing to a more, still higher than his career line, but now it's starting to be more in line with what we thought he was going to be.
Yeah, that's good.
So, yay for having him for a couple more years.
Yay for actually meeting expectations.
Yep.
My Yankee of the Week is going to go to... I'll give it to... If Brandon McCarthy didn't get hit kind of hard the other day, it would go to him because he threw that shutout. But since he did, I think I'll go with Shane Green. He's pretty great again against the Tigers, and I believe he was okay in his last start before that as well.
I am in agreement with that.
As we discussed, if he could become a thing, that would really be helpful.
Please.
Okay, in the start before the last one, he went 5 innings and gave up 9 hits and 3 runs. But
okay, that's not.
That's, great. Well, there's always Michael Pineda, who was pretty great in his one start.
Yeah.
Yep.
He's an honorary Yankee of the Week because he was pretty awesome. Okay, Matt F., your Mitre of the Week.
It's Derek Jeter.
Yeah, that's accurate.
I remember when he used to be good. It wasn't this back year.
Back when we were on horse and carriage and communicating and doing our podcast by telegraph.
Yes. The guy I say, you hear about this young chap?
I can read it all in MySpace.
Extra, read all about it.
Yes, I wrote about how Jeter was terrific on my live journal.
And put it on my AIM profile.
Yes. Keep a record of his batting line. Yeah.
A LA message of I love Jeets.
All right. Yeah. Jeter.
My Tamagotchi pet Jeter.
Jeter ran away. All right. Matt P., your Mitre of the Week.
Ugh, I hate to say this, and I know Greg's going to kill me, but Brett Gardner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's hit a bit of a wall. and he got a little hurt, and yeah, it sucks. But it's more just like him regressing to, you know, what he actually is, which is more of like a league average hitter with great defense, not a great hitter with, you know, good defense. So it's not going to kill his season. He's still having like the best season on the team.
Yeah, I would say so.
Which is crazy because people wanted to trade him for Brandon Phillips.
That would have been terrible.
Imagine the alternate reality where that happened.
All right, my Mitre of the week is Sean Kelly because he's been terrible. Even beyond today, he hasn't pitched that well in the last week. And, I mean, yeah. I think he is, you know, like we talk about David Robertson is kind of a different reliever because he's been so consistent. Sean Kelly is like your typical reliever who will like occasionally have games where he strikes out a ton of people and he looks terrific. But then in other games, you know, like today, he'll get beat up by the Tigers and have nothing on a slider. Then in the previous game, he went 2/3 of an inning against the White Sox and gave up 2 hits and a run and a walked one. So he's not exactly doing his job.
Yeah. That era may be ending soon.
Maybe.
Because eventually that gravy train ends, and eventually Joe Girardi has the trusted reliever title that he puts on relievers, and I think Sean Kelly's starting to lose his.
Yeah, kind of like how Adam Warren kind of disappeared for a couple weeks there.
Yeah.
They could always bring back Mike Zagurski.
He's sitting by his phone waiting.
Yes. He's actually kind of eating his phone, too.
So you better hurry up. You got to call him now.
Oh, my God. It's Mr. Steinbrenner's box.
Oh, my God. Is Mike Zagurski eating George Steinbrenner in Steinbrenner's box?
He's eating the Monument Park flag. Mike Zagurski's career ERA is 7.05 in 75 innings. So, well done, sir. It all comes back to Mike Zagurski. All right. Well, I think that'll do it for the Pinstripe Ballet podcast. Do you guys have anything else?
I don't think so.
Guess what month Carlos May was best in?
Was it May?
No, it was April.
He's like, they're like, hey, Carlos, your month is coming. He's like, no, this is my month. Carlos.
To be fair, it was his sixth month, but
yeah. Okay. So, yeah, we're done. My brain's not functioning right now. So, that'll do it for the Pinstripe Alley podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Pinstripe Alley. Follow the GIFs account at PSA_GIFs. Follow me on Twitter at Mearns PSA. Follow Matt F on Twitter at MattF15. You can follow Matt Provenzano at Twitter at MattProv94. And like us on Facebook, facebook.com/PinstripeAlley. Rate and review us on iTunes. And submit to the sweet bag for your questions. We always love answering them, no matter how ridiculous. Even if you think that Girardi is not really being a good manager. Do you think Tanya is a good manager?
Yes.
Yes. Of Spinstrap Lowly.
Yes. Turner Brindern. This that turns to Birdie. All right, I hope you enjoy listening to this podcast on SB Nation. Nishern. Oh, God, this is all deteriorating. Like Derek Jeter. Okay.
iTunes on, subscribe to us on iTunes.
iTunes. Oh, man. Much typo. Such error. Wow. All right. That'll do it for us on the Finster Valley podcast. Have a good night.